This is the West Texas Dispatch. I'm George Levesque. Early voting is underway in the Texas primaries. Local voters get to have their say in the hot races at the top of the ticket, like the race for U.S. Senate. And even local races are more competitive than they have been in years. Today, we're taking a look at House District 71. The seat is open after Stan Lambert announced he would retire from the state house. There are four Republican candidates competing for the nomination in the general election, where they will face the sole Democratic candidate, Diana Luna. Republican Liz Case lost to Lambert in the 2024 Republican primary election by a small margin of just 2.4%. Case is running for the State House District 71 seat again this election. Case graduated from Texas Christian University in 1986, and her career experience includes working as a political activist. She sat down with KACU's Bailey Simon to talk about her campaign and what issues matter most to her.
Thank you, Liz, for coming in today.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
What do you think are the most important issues of this election, and what are voters commonly voicing their concerns are to you?
One of the things that people talk to me about the most is property taxes. There are people that are on the campaign trail right now who are saying, I'm going to eliminate property taxes. And, you know, that makes you popular with people, but I'm not going to make somebody a promise I can't keep. I don't think you can do that. One of the things that I think is important is to give taxpayers back the control. We need more accountability with our local taxing entities. And if they're going to raise your taxes, you should be able to vote on that. And if in your local area you don't get two-thirds majority of a vote, then they should not be raising your taxes.
And talking about the AI data centers, Texas is seeing rapid growth in these centers, often built on farmland. Do you think there should be guardrails on where and how these projects are built?
100%. There's not been a lot of transparency. Even those of us that are running for office weren't aware that this data center was coming in until the president announced it. What makes people the most unhappy is that it's happening behind their back, where they're being put. We need to be able to incentivize these companies to put them someplace besides our prime farmland. It's going to be on the 90th legislature to write some standards for what these AI companies can do with the electricity and also with the water, because water is huge.
Last session, the state legislature tackled several water issues, but not all priorities for West Texas were addressed. What water issues do you think are most important and should be focused on for West Texas?
We put forward several billion dollars from the legislature last session, and I think that will help the problem some. We've got some areas where they have started projects, water projects here, and haven't finished them. And so that funding just has to be fought for. And when it's your senator who's leading the charge on the water projects, that is very helpful. I've already been talked to by elected officials who are like, okay, my city needs this. We need this much for this, and we need this much for this. And so I already have a list of things that need to be tackled from that perspective.
The 2026 to 27 school year will be the first year for school vouchers. Are you satisfied with how the state set up this system?
They say they've given school choice to the school children of Texas, which sounds great. But the reality is that really is only going to affect less than 2% of the students in Texas. And I think we need to focus on our public schools so that the majority of our kids are going to be ready for those jobs that haven't even been invented. We are not meeting their needs right now.
The state faces critical labor shortages, particularly in healthcare and education. How do you think the state can incentivize healthcare professionals to work in rural hospitals and clinics?
My kids graduated from college. They didn't want to come out to a smaller rural place. They want to stay in the big city with all the traffic and all the craziness. And that's what mindset that a lot of people have. So I think we're going to have to be smart about having things that attract them. And in all honesty, this AI data center is going to bring a lot of those things. So I think in Abilene, that will take care of itself. We do need doctors and nurses moving to our area. So I think besides incentivizing them money-wise, I think the kind of rural health care, as in the facilities that we have, we're going to have to keep improving those.
Texas has had a Republican leadership for more than two decades. Issues like property tax relief, support for law enforcement, and school funding continue to be major campaign themes. Why do you think those issues remain unsolved after so many years of unified leadership?
In West Texas and East Texas, a Democrat can't get elected out here. So if you have really liberal views, you have to run as a Republican. And I think we have had too many of those Republicans who have an R by their name, which means rhino, not real Republican. That's what's been happening. And we've seen it in the votes that the House has taken, because there are many, many issues that I can name that have passed the Senate. Year after year, session after session after session, that can't get through the House because the House is predominantly full of rhinos.
Former Representative Stan Lambert took an unpopular stance on school vouchers, defying the governor and other leaders. If elected and you were put into a similar situation like that, would you go for the way that your district needs, or would you side with the state legislature?
I've been going down there for 10 years. Leadership already knows who I am, and I'm already unpopular with them because I've been standing up for issues that are conservative issues. So they're not necessarily the issues that the leadership is in favor of. So I said, it doesn't matter. I'm used to being unpopular. You know, when you're a school teacher, a single mother of four teenagers, when you're somebody who takes a position on political things, you're going to be unpopular. So it's fine with me to be unpopular. To me, every decision's got to be based on whether it's the right thing to do, not the popular thing to do. So you've got to figure out what's right from a godly standpoint. You have to figure out what the people in your district want. And we know that leadership is going to try to twist your arm, but that's not who's in charge. And I would be their worst nightmare, because there are people that they can bully. There are people that they can get in the popular boys club. We know that the system is set up to where they'll tell you when you campaign, you know, you tell your folks at home that you're conservative and you're this and this and this. But when you get down here in Austin, we're all just going to get along. And we're not going to have these divisions. We all just need to be buddies. Well, I'm sorry. If you have those liberal stances and you think it's okay to kill babies and you think it's okay to chop perfectly good body parts off of little seven-year-olds, then we don't have a lot of common ground. And so there are issues that are worth standing for. And if I'm the only one standing, that's okay. I've done that a lot of times before. So you've just got to stand for what's right.
So your opponents in the primary, what leadership qualities do you feel you possess over them that makes you the best candidate for this position?
The bottom line when it comes down to it is experience. Nobody has been down to the legislature and has worked on policy. Especially from a conservative activist side. And the last 6 years in particular, that's what I've been doing. That's something that takes a long time to understand, the system of Austin and how they work and what their tricks are. And there's a lot to learn. And I've been doing it 10 years.
You can find links to Liz Casey's campaign and the extended version of Bailey's conversation with her on the KACU website, kacu.org. Our second candidate conversation is with Joshua Olmacher. Olmacher is a new candidate in the field this time around. He's a father of six and a local project manager. He grew up in a military family and spent part of his childhood living overseas, including in the Middle East, where he was exposed to different cultures that has helped shape his perspective, he says. KACU's Inohosino Izwa started their conversation by asking Olmacher about his view on how his party has used its dominance in state politics to achieve its goals.
There has not been a Democrat elected statewide in 32 years here in Texas. Texas has had Republican leadership in the governorship and in Texas legislature for more than two decades. Why do the issues of cutting property tax, standing with law enforcement, and school funding continue?
I think part of that is, I don't want to say it's because there have not been Democrats elected, but there hasn't been enough Democrats that have posed strong enough of a challenge. One of the big issues that I have with the Republican Party, even as somebody who's running as a Republican, is we claim to be the party of small government, but I think that that gets lost a little bit whenever there is such a dominant run, such that we can have a governor who kind of beats to the beat of his own, or walks to the beat of his own drum, and will push for the things that he wants. And when he doesn't get them, he's got the money and the support to push people out and bring somebody in that he wants. You know, my particular policies are not such that I would want, you know, a lot of Democrats elected, but I do think that a stronger Democratic coalition would be better for Texas because it would put more pressure on Republicans to actually deliver on the things that they say that they're trying to deliver.
You said that there was a sermon from the Well Church that inspired you to run for office. So I was wondering if you go a little bit more into detail about how did that translate to you running for office specifically?
We were coming up on the 2024 election, and he goes, would one of you run for office and give me somebody I actually want to vote for? And I've been interested in politics for a long time, and I specifically felt that there was a calling in that message to me. But I'd kind of put it aside because I have six children. I'm working full-time. And within a month of that, there was separate conversations with my wife and with my boss kind of saying that they thought I should get involved also. Which kind of removed those barriers and kind of, I feel like, affirmed that calling.
So Commissioner Sid Miller is calling for guardrails to be put in place on the growth of AI data centers across Texas farmlands. Would you want any limits on new AI data center projects?
I don't know if I would say limits. I definitely think that there's a need for more regulation. I think that there's a lot of folks who are concerned right now about the growth of AI, the amount of people that are coming through town, the cost, the housing costs that are associated. They're concerned about water and power and all these things. Long term, I take the data centers coming here as a win. Very much how Dyess Air Force Base anchors us as a vital part of the broader American defense infrastructure and everything else like that. I think having these major data centers here will allow us who doesn't, you know, this region doesn't have a lot of people, but if it's got these critical pieces like this, it'll set us up to have a bigger seat at the table when it comes to making sure that any of these concerns are addressed. And so I think what we're facing right now is kind of a gap in the middle where, yeah, there's stuff that we need to figure out. We need to make sure that we're holding these companies that are putting these data centers in accountable to the people around them. And I have confidence that that will be the case.
Are you concerned about the AI data center needs? I'm referring to power grids.
If we go back 5 years and we look at the winter storm that we had, it exposed a lot of vulnerabilities that we had in our grid. And I think there's been a lot of good work done to help harden that in the time since. If anything, AI to me almost feels like a long, drawn-out coming winter storm of 2020 where we say, you know, the amount of power that they're talking about for just this one in Abilene is enough to power, I think they say something like 700,000 homes for a year. I do have concerns about supporting that, but I have confidence that there is the ability to generate this power. And so that's where like your earlier question about regulation, I think comes in, that we make sure that one, that these data centers are helping, either fund their own generation or helping pay to fund generation for that. And I also need to make sure that whenever we do have incidences where the grid pushes towards capacity, that we look at something like regulation that would prioritize residences, small businesses, the pillars of the community that were already there, and not end up in a situation where because they are buying more, they're getting the better price, and as the grid fills, then we're left with rising costs. And so I have high hopes for the ability of the grid to maintain, for the work that we've been doing for the last 5 years to continue to strengthen. But I don't want to see something where we're now taking advantage of the work that's been done for the last 5 years and putting us in a vulnerable position like we were prior to these winter storms.
So last session, the state legislator led by State Senator Charles Perry, he worked on issues around water, and some legislation caught traction, but not all the priorities West Texas wanted. So what would you be fighting for?
Water is one of these areas where I think we can all agree that it is important. I think that the overall structure of water rights in Texas is complicated in knowing who has rights to what lakes and which reservoirs and things. I think the primary thing that we need to be fighting for is to continue to build our capacity, to make sure that we're working on future reservoir projects, that whenever we're talking about things like data centers, which is just such a big topic, that we're doing things like, as part of the regulations, trying to push them towards closed-loop water systems, the ability to recapture the water that they've used for reuse, just so that we're reducing the strain. And so I think there's two major things. Increase our ability to maintain and hold water because the usage is going up. And then on the other hand, we need to make sure that we're being good stewards of it, especially with these data centers coming in, and that we're holding them accountable at the state level for that.
What positions do you disagree with your opponents about? If there are any specific ones that you feel like there's a very big difference in your stances?
I think there's less disagreement on stances as there is on where we are in our lives. A big point that I've kind of made to kind of differentiate myself a little bit is that I am working a full-time job in this district. I am raising kids in this district. If we're talking about wanting legislators who have to bear the weight of the laws that they pass, I think I'm in a position where I bear more weight than my opponents on anything that's done in Austin or in Washington, for that matter. If there is anything specific right now, I think when it comes to some of the narrative from some of my opponents around the rise of radical Islam in Texas, I think that radical Islam is not a good thing. I'm not going to be pro, jihad, but I think that we need to be careful about not letting our politics stain our potential to witness to these people as Christians, because the bulk of them are here because they want to be here, because they want to make a better life here. Their religion is different than ours, but I think the more that we do to antagonize with the sword of the government, the harder it's going to be to go to them with the word of Christ, especially when in this day and age, so often Republican is kind of placed next to Christian as if they're some synonymous thing. And so I do think we need to be careful about that. And I have some differences on how I would like us to be talking about these things. But aside from that, we were at the Police Officers Association, all four of us, on Wednesday night. And one of the questions we got at the end of all of the other questions, one of the guys goes, well, what do y'all disagree on? We agree on more than we disagree on. The major difference that you'll find is where our priorities are. My priorities are on trying to run government the way the founders wanted, on limiting the size and scope of government, making sure that when government does have power and control, it's as close to the taxpayer, as close to the people as it can be. If that means moving stuff from Washington to Austin, if that means moving stuff from Austin to Abilene, that's kind of where my priority is, less so than maybe diving into social or cultural issues.
if you faced that kind of situation where the governor wants you to vote one way and you want to go a different way, will you be voting for West Texas issues or statewide or party issues?
I've said this a lot throughout the course of my campaign. There's 190-something thousand people in our district. The job is representative of those people. My goal, if I'm elected, is to be the representative for District 71. I have on my name tag Republican. My goal is not to be a Republican representative. It's not to be a representative of the governor or the lieutenant governor or the attorney general. Where we can find common ground, where the things that they want line up with our district, I think that's great. Where we don't, I'm fully ready to have those fights.
You can find more information on Joshua Omacher's campaign, including the extended version of this conversation, at kacu.org. When we come back, we'll hear from Chance Ferguson, not a newcomer to politics in the big country, but making his first run for the State House seat. Stay tuned. This is the West Texas Dispatch. Early voting kicked off this week in Texas' 2026 primary election. Today we're bringing you conversations with candidates for House District 71. We heard from Liz Case and Joshua Omacher in the first half of the show. With five-term incumbent Stan Lambert not seeking re-election, the Republican primary is more crowded than usual. Chance Ferguson is an Abilene resident whose family has been local to this area for generations. After spending decades in public service, he decided to move to the political sector. Ferguson unsuccessfully challenged Congressman Jody Arrington in the 2024 primary. Now Ferguson is taking his shot at the State House seat. KACU's Josiah Wannell sat down with Ferguson to hear his take on the issues.
Talking about the Texas workforce, the state faces some critical labor shortages. Is there a way that you think as the state can incentivize healthcare professionals to work in rural hospitals and clinics?
Well, that's a good question. And I keep saying this in all my forums and stuff, that people say that if you find yourself as the smartest individual in the room, then you're in the wrong room, that you have to surround yourself with people that are smarter than you. And so when I have meetings and things with, I've met with so many doctors and surgeons and anesthesiologists and nurse practitioners and nurses and people that are in the healthcare industry. And I keep telling them, I'm like, guys, I'm not a healthcare professional. You are going to have to educate me on what the problem is and where do we start to fix it. So I don't necessarily have all the answers to that. That would come down to me talking to them and asking them, where do we start to better the problem?
I was going to talk about it later, but I think it's such a big part of what I've read and what I've seen from your entire campaign. You mentioned that if elected, collaboration will be key. And there's a lot of different parts of that. What does that mean to you in terms of collaboration, and how will that play out in your time as a legislator if elected at a more broad scale?
Well, to me, collaboration is key. It's so important, and we haven't had that. You know, Stan Lambert shut his office down 5 years ago in Abilene. Has never reopened it, and that's one of the biggest things I hear from people is, you know, he doesn't meet with people. He doesn't collaborate and find out the problems of the issues. So, for instance, let's take infrastructure. Okay, our water problem. I mean, it's always a problem, right? I mean, we're still on the Cedar Point Reservoir. We're trying to get that finished. We're 10 years out. You know, if I want to look at the water issue, I'm not a water guy. What I'm going to do is we cover four counties here. I don't care what's happening in Austin. I don't care what's happening in San Antonio, Dallas. I don't care. I care about HD 71. Now, there are things that deal with the state of Texas that I do care about, but I've got to put us first. It's kind of like Trump saying America first. That's what I'm going to do in my campaign. It's HD 71 first, and then we'll worry about the rest of it later. But like I said, I'm not a water guy. So one thing I would do is I would go to each water district in every town, every community, every county, and I would have a meeting with those individuals and say, okay, let's look. How do we fix this problem? Okay, our state highways and things like that. I would get with the Department of Transportation in every one of the four counties and their head honchos. I'd get with people that actually work out on the streets and know what they're talking about. I would get those guys involved in the communication process and say, where do we start? What can we do to help fix this problem? And I would do that in every aspect of our problem solving you know, education. I would be meeting with principals, teachers. How do we fix the problem? Same as I've done with the doctors. Where do we start? And every one of them told me the first thing to do is get rid of non-competes. And I said, okay. I said, so if I get elected, that's the first thing I'm going to do is try to do legislation where we don't have non-compete clauses.
Moving to education, the 2026 to 2027 school year will be the first year for school vouchers. Are you satisfied with how the state system is set up right now? And is there anything on the overall scale that you're looking at that you would want to really hit if elected?
I've actually had some meetings with school board administrators and stuff, and I'm an active shooter instructor for a lot of the school systems around the Abilene area. So I get to meet with superintendents and teachers and principals and school board members, and I get to ask them what are the problems with their school. And here's what I'm hearing. School vouchers really hasn't affected us that much here in the big country because it's more for bigger cities with bigger problems. You know, if you're in kind of the lower impoverished areas of, say, Houston, and you're really worried about your child being there and his influence with gangs and things like that. With school vouchers, you could pull them out. You could take them to a charter school, things like that. You could homeschool them. It's not really affecting us out here in that sense for school vouchers because if you're like me, I grew up in Merkel. Okay. My parents wouldn't pull me out of Merkel and send me somewhere else just because of a school voucher. We liked living in Merkel. We liked the small community. And most people are the same here. They're not going to pull their child out just for a school voucher program because we don't have the problems. But at the end of the day, school vouchers are here. They're not going away. It got pushed by the governor. It got pushed by Donald Trump. I mean, they're here. They're not going away. We just have to learn how to best live with them. Now, my problem with the education system right now is the state of Texas looks at our public education system and our schools as one big cookie. And they think a cookie cutter fits all of them. And it doesn't. For instance, you know, some of our schools, like I met with Wiley ISD, and I found out it was an astronomical amount of money they have to pay every time they go out of town to play a football game because they have to go somewhere as far as El Paso and places like that. And then if they have to get a hotel and then the gas money and taking the band and taking the football team, and even if they went to go do some kind of academic thing like theater, I mean, it can still run into the thousands of dollars, you know, anywhere from $20,000 to $60,000 to go compete because there's nowhere local at the same level. Whereas if you go to Dallas-Fort Worth or Houston or San Antonio, they can travel within an hour and compete everywhere they need to compete. So when Texas looks at education as a cookie cutter, there are schools out there just like I said, like Wiley, Abilene High, Cooper, they're probably all the same, that they don't get travel reimbursement and things like that. It's supposed to be part of their budget, but when they get their budget, none of that is included in. So it's not the same. You can't model your whole school education program and act like it fits every individual school.
I've seen that you've been really intentional in talking to voters and just having discussion over the table. I know that you go to Front Porch to have those conversations.
Well, and that comes back to interaction with the community. You know, every person that is running for this office or even running for your U.S. congressman or even your county commissioner, your JP, they're all going to get up there and say the same thing. And if you look at all of our deals, you're going to see conservative Republican, you know, wants to help healthcare, wants to help education, wants to help the infrastructure. Everybody's saying the same thing. I think it comes down to the people who truly want to talk to the residents of HD 71 and find out what their problems are. You know, another thing we hear is property taxes. Also, I want to hear the complaints and how we can better people's living conditions here in HD 71. And if you don't get out and talk to the people and you don't meet with them, you're never going to know. You're going to be out of touch. And it's time that we have somebody in office that's of the people and not above the people. And I can't tell you the number of times people have called me and what is your stance on this? And I said, you know, I can answer that, but I think it's a better conversation to have face to face. Why don't we meet for coffee? And I'll schedule something at 8:30 in the morning. We'll go drink coffee and we'll have discussions about it. But that is how you change things for the better, is finding out the problems and listening to your constituents. And we haven't had that for quite some time.
Switching to artificial intelligence, Texas is seeing rapid growth in AI centers all over the state, but specifically here, often on farmland. Do you think that there should be guardrails on where and how these projects are built?
These AI data centers, they should be forced to have a buffer zone around them, much like the military has what's called an ETJ, an extraterritorial jurisdiction. And the problem is the data centers come in and they say, okay, well, we're going to pay you $20,000 an acre or even $1 million an acre or whatever. They paid some astronomical figures to some of these people to buy their land. Well, the people they didn't offer it to, now all of a sudden their property values have plummeted. They live right across the street from this thing. They'll never be able to sell it. But if we, in the negotiation phase of this, would have said, that's fine, but you're going to put a buffer around your property so that people that are left have enough distance between you and the AI facility that it doesn't so much affect their property values. And that should have happened in the planning phases.
Looking forward, what is your message to the voters of District 71 as you run this campaign?
You know, I just encourage everybody, if you don't want to vote for me, man, that's awesome. Vote for who you feel is the best candidate, because that's what our country was founded on. People that have to get in arguments and just fight about stuff. I mean, even I've got friends that are Democrats and that we get along. We don't always agree on things, but we don't have to be hateful. I mean, I just encourage everybody, you know, just have a heart of God and love everybody. You know, if you don't want to vote for somebody, then don't vote for them. But you don't have to trash people. You know, the other thing that I would say is just don't listen to what somebody's telling you. Research your candidates. If somebody tells you, vote for Chance Ferguson, okay, man, that's great. Thank you for your support. Go research me. Find out. I mean, there's nothing I have ever said that is not 100% accurate in the truth. I haven't stretched anything. What you see is what you get.
Check out KACU.org for more information on Chance Ferguson's campaign and all of the interviews in this series. Jay Hardaway is also running, but had a last-minute scheduling conflict and wasn't able to do his interview with us. We're working to reschedule with him, and we'll add that to our website as soon as it's available. Next week, we take a look at the primary election season and focus on the race for Texas Congressional District 19. Be sure to tune in. The Stargate Data Center, the massive 4 million square foot complex being built in Abilene, is set to be completed by the end of this year. The project has brought in some 6,000 workers, compounding the already existing shortage of housing and driving up rent prices dramatically. The Texas Standard's David Brown recently spoke with Time Magazine correspondent Andrew Chow, and we wanted to share that conversation with you.
What brought you to look into what was happening in Abilene? I gather you're based out of Washington, D.C.?
This is part of a larger reporting project that I've done over the last couple years about how data centers are remaking America. So I've traveled to Granbury, Texas, and Memphis, and everywhere the issues sort of caused by the data centers are a little bit different. In Granbury, it was noise pollution, and in Memphis, it was concerns about air quality. So I didn't quite know actually what the effects were going to be when I showed up in Abilene in November. I wanted to check it out because it's the flagship location of Donald Trump's big AI infrastructure project that he announced in the first week of his presidency. And when I got to Abilene, all anybody wanted to talk about was housing.
Housing, housing, housing. What were you hearing when it came to housing?
The first thing that people wanted to sort of say is that it seemed like a classic supply and demand thing. So yeah, you have a massive rise in demand because all these out-of-town workers are coming. They're making good wages, often working at the plant, constructing it really, really fast. But Abilene already had a housing crunch, local housing experts told me. And so that was really driving up rental prices in an unsustainable way. Now, landlords obviously love this because they can charge way, way more. But this is really causing vulnerable or low-income people. It's giving them nowhere to go. So a lot more people are being forced out onto the streets.
Wow. So when we talk about the severity of the housing crunch there, Has there been any sign of let up? I mean, are we seeing new construction in Abilene to try to offset the numbers of people who are coming to town to work on this huge infrastructure project?
The one major thing that the city has done is greenlit RV parks to hold thousands of more residents. But all the RV parks are maxed out right now, and I was staying in a motel. The motels are maxed out too. The city says they're trying to work on solutions, but It seems like they were maybe caught a little bit off guard and didn't understand maybe how severe this problem was. So the RV parks are coming, but they have not arrived yet. And compounding the problem is that this Stargate data center is not the only data center coming to town. There are a lot more coming to the area, and that could really exacerbate the issue.
I would imagine, though, that at a time when you've got a real premium on places to live, that, well, as you were saying about, say, landlords, for example, they're probably seeing the ability to raise rental rates. Are we seeing home prices going up as well? I mean, is this a housing boom time in Abilene right now?
Yeah, that's what I've heard from one housing expert, that housing prices are going up as well. So yes, this is an unevenly distributed impact where it's really benefiting some people and it's hurting others.
What is the city trying to do about, I mean, are they facing now a bona fide homeless problem like what you might see in a much larger city like Dallas or Houston or something like that? Or is this... more low key.
I spent some time driving around the city with a community worker who says that the homelessness issue in Abilene is the worst he's ever seen it in his decade plus in the city. It seems to me that, and to him, that it's gotten quite worse. I can't say, you know, compared to Dallas. The city says, you know, that the data center is helping fuel the local economy, like the hotels, the restaurants, the tradespeople, and that they're, you know, trying to work on solutions for the housing crunch.
But once these data centers are built out, I would imagine that they're not going to sustain the number of jobs that, of course, you're currently seeing there in Abilene. Right now, it's very much a spike. Is it possible that suddenly we could see prices crashing, and perhaps because of that, a reluctance among builders to make big investments in housing projects right now?
That's right. So one of the big things about data centers is all of the jobs and the investment is front-loaded in the construction. Once these data centers go up, there's actually very few jobs inside the working data center.
Once
so
it's
a
up
lot
and
of
running,
these.
Yeah.
Once it's up and running. So a lot of these workers will simply leave town and go to the next construction project. So there is that risk that if you overbuild housing now, then it could really fall fallow later. I think that's probably one of the reasons why they're looking for, you know, they greenlit the RV parks first instead of, you know, long-term housing. But obviously that means there's still a huge crunch right now.
Was there anything that really surprised you about putting together this story in Abilene? One of the reasons I ask that is because you mentioned that you've been going to other cities where you've seen the AI boom play out. And I'm curious, are those other places not experiencing these sort of housing issues? Or was there something unique to Abilene that you thought, wow, this is why is this happening?
The issue of housing seems most acute in Abilene compared to other places right now. It's funny because, yeah, I talked to data center activists across the country, and they all are worried about a slightly different thing, whether it's their electricity bills going up mm-hmm. or a potential risk of grid instability or water. So it sort of manifests differently based on the locale, and it seems like housing was the main impact here so far.
Did you get a sense that local officials have any answers about what to do, at least in the short term?
No. They pointed to the RV parks. They say they're trying to work with local builders to find solutions. But, you know, this is, you know, almost a year since the project was really greenlit, and it doesn't seem like they have a real strategy to deal with the issue right now to get people into shelters, into homes.
That's Andrew Chow, a correspondent for Time Magazine, speaking with The Texas Standard's David Brown. Chow's coverage of the housing crisis in Abilene was published earlier this month. We will continue to report on this issue and efforts to find solutions. This is the West Texas Dispatch. Abilene audiences have the opportunity to catch a show this weekend that tells the story of a young woman's journey of self-acceptance. Abilene Christian University will perform the musical Violet on the stage of the Folks Theater. KACU's Heather Claiborne spoke with the director, Dawn Swearingen-Meeks, about the show.
So this show follows the story of a young woman who's dealing with the impact of an injury that's left a visible scar and her struggles with how that makes her see herself. What about this musical resonated with you to want to put it on the stage?
There are so many beautiful themes to unpack in this musical, Heather. You know, we all in our, you know, journey of life, and this is literally a story of a woman on a bus seeking out a preacher that she believes can provide healing. We all have those little bumps in the road. I guess when you walk through something that is unexpected and traumatic, you're shaped by it. I tell my students that all the time as we work to show our, as I say, show your undersides, your vulnerability. And I was really struck by that statement. I think our world right now more than ever needs a story of hope. And this story is of hope. It is a faith journey story. It is a story of self-love, forgiveness, from a daughter to a father. And that just spoke to me. The music is absolutely glorious as well. So, it's been a glorious journey.
Well, and it is set in the 60s. It deals not just with identity and healing, but also racism and faith, as you
mentioned.
Amen,
yes.
How does the civil rights era fit into telling the story?
Oh, thank you for asking that. It's such an important piece. So Violet, on her journey, she meets two servicemen. And in that, both of those characters, Monty and Flick, one is a person of color and one is Caucasian. And we get little nuggets, little tidbits about who each of these people are on their journey. Janine Tesori and Brian Crawley, who wrote the lyrics and the story and composed this beautiful piece, also shout out to Shrek. Janine Tesori was the composer and lyricist for that. We are left to our own kind of imagination to fill in the blanks. And so right out of the gate, the first bus stop, we experience a statement of racism. And Flick, played by Riley Wilson, he is a senior from Michigan, just a brilliant talent. He'll be showcasing in New York in March. And so proud of each of these students. There is this exchange with the counter manager there as Violet walks up and asks for a tuna fish sandwich and essentially says, you know, in not such a pretty way, you know, what are you doing here? You are not invited into this space. And so his friend Monty steps up and in that essentially says, come on, Flick, you know, we've got better things to do. And Violet essentially says, what if I'm traveling with them? And then there's a statement there, too, about her being female and, you know, the implication that she's not strong or she can't make wise choice making in the world. And so I love the statement. And on that journey, there's a little old lady who's on the bus and she befriends Violet. She also talks about, you know, there's a little reference to her son. And so for each of these characters, one of the things that I've said to all of our, because this is ensemble heavy, and I've said every company member is so important as we unpack these truths, these statements to say that we are all invited to the table as the Lord has created each of us equally, is how do we see one another as you turn on the bus, another person that's on the bus, that character might identify with. And we've talked a lot about these moments of open heart or closed heart. How do we come to find forgiveness and healing? So many amazing themes, but the racial piece that unpacking the discrimination is so important, and it's close to my heart. I have a child that is mixed, and Charlie is just my bright light, and so pleased to be able to unpack that. And as you talked about themes, that would be one of them that's near and dear. So,
you've shared a couple of moments of the show. Do you have one moment that stands out as your absolute favorite? As you look at the way that your group is putting this on the stage.
Can I say two? Two moments?
Go ahead.
The first is what I call our baptismal moment. I don't know that necessarily it was written to be this way. We're honoring the story. There is this moment where young Violet, because there's a series of flashbacks between grown Violet and young Violet and father, and there are all these references to the Jordan River. And of course, as people of faith, we know so much about what water means in, you know, our Christian text. The bravery of the parting of the seas, baptismal spaces, walking on water, etc. And so in this, there's a reference to there's the river, we need to cross it. And so Father is working to bring young Violet across, working to find this place of healing. The second, which is my absolute favorite, is the final moment of the show. This statement, bring me to light, is the name of this last number, and it is one act, and it just rolls one piece into the next, like the bus journey that we invite the patrons into. But I just almost weep every night as I watch it. The statement of healing and illumination and trust in the Lord and renewal, and the company comes together, and it's just absolutely stirring. I just can't wait for our audiences to see this story and to hear the beautiful lyrics.
And is it an all-ages show?
I'd say probably 14 and up. My 10-year-old Henry is my little shadow. So he has walked the whole journey with me, but we are very careful to talk about themes and unpack so he understands what he's processing and watching.
Well, I can't wait to get to see it this Sunday.
Thank you, Heather.
Dawn Swearingen-Mix, thank you so much for coming to tell us about it.
Thank you. Get your tickets, call the box office, go online. We have buy one, get one free right now in Student Rush for $15. So we open Thursday.
Heather Claiborne speaking with ACU theater professor and the director of the musical Violet. On the stage this weekend in the Falks Theater, shows will be at 7:30 Thursday through Saturday with a 2 p.m. matinee on Sunday. This has been the West Texas Dispatch. Thanks for tuning in. We're here each Wednesday at noon. Plan to join us and tell a friend. And if your friend isn't able to tune in Wednesdays at noon, let them know they can subscribe to the podcast. West Texas Dispatch is available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You can find it on the KACU mobile app. We had help this week from our executive producer, Heather Claiborne, and our digital editor, Calvin Claiborne. Special thanks to JC Gamble, who wrote our theme. I'm George Levesque.